Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 181 of Registry Matters. How are you, Larry? Good evening. Welcome.
Fantastic, but it is a little bit warm here. My thermometer shows 99.
99? Oh my God, that's pretty damn hot.
That's all.
But you have, what, 2% humidity?
Probably in the 5 to 7% range today, oh, I'm guessing.
I was being silly and I'm not far off. Okay, I think it is 99% humidity where I am. And it's probably not in the 90s anymore. It's in the 80s. So I'm not sure. I think my temperature might exceed yours. The feel-like temperature.
So, well, what do we have going on tonight?
Oh, you want me to do this? I was going to ask you that question.
You're going to ask me that. Okay.
Larry, what do we have going on this night, this evening?
Well, we have a landmark case out of South Carolina that we're going to talk about dealing with PFRs and the constitutionality of the registry. And we have a lead-in case. We're going to talk about the Armed Career Crime Act or whatever it is, ACCA. I forget what that all stands for. We're going to talk about that, a Supreme Court decision. And we've got a prisoner contribution, and we've got a NARSOL member contribution from the website. And I think we've got a patron question, and we've got all sorts of good things. We're going to be here trying to jam-pack all this into a one-hour podcast.
Very, very well. I think we should probably get going, and let's go for the patron question right out of the bat. And this longtime patron, Mike in New Jersey, he and I have been having conversations back and forth lately, and he says, hey, a quickie for Larry. Can the international Megan's Law be valid? Shouldn't something like that go through the treaty process? Super neat question, Larry. I thought it was good enough to throw on the show.
Well, he is correct if it were a treaty, but it isn't. If it were a treaty between nations, but what this is, as I understand it, and I have never professed myself to be an expert, but on this, as I understand it, this is a model law that has been offered to different countries. And if they adopt this, something similar to this, it's a choice that the nation makes. So the country of Zimbabwe might not make the same choice of how to implement their version because their technology may be different, their criminal records keeping may be different, their sentencing schemes may be different, and you would have different variations on the exchange of information. But the international component is that nations have been urged to communicate with one another about people who have been convicted of sexual offenses in order to preclude them from traveling with the intent of engaging in further criminality. And the thought goes that if you have a prior conviction, that might enhance the odds that you would be engaging in travel for sexual exploitation purposes. That's the theory behind it. It's not a good theory, but that's the theory behind the international Megan's Law.
Okay. Let's see. I'm trying to even dig into this a little bit. So it's just a law that got made, but it is something of a reciprocal law, I guess. I mean, is there an equivalent IML type framework? Let's just say in the UK, pick random country that this isn't. The treaty would be some sort of compact between multiple countries agreeing to this thing, and they all have signed on to some sort of thing. Like we've heard about treaties recently where it's the trade treaties and things like that to push back. But so we created our own IML. Then does Germany and the UK have their own, whatever they would be called, IML there to force the notification and all that stuff in the other direction?
I don't know which nations have created something that approximates a sharing of information on those convicted of sexual offenses. I don't know if Germany has such a thing. Countries have. In fact, I was on a flight traveling to a criminal defense lawyers meeting, and I ended up sitting next to a seat of a person who was in the foreign service of one of the African nations, which name is escaping me. I don't remember. It was Nigeria, where. And she asked me what I was doing there, and I told her I was talking about issues related to our people on the sex offense registry. And she says, unfortunately, that's coming to our country as well. She said, we're under enormous pressure to crack down and make information available and to receive information, particularly from the more affluent countries, so that we don't have people come in and doing bad things to our children. And so what I'm trying to communicate is that the United States is probably, to my recollection, the instigator of the version of international Megan's Law that we have. And the U.S. has been encouraging other nations to do similar things, to adopt similar laws. How close they are to mirroring the United States, I don't know. But I know that information is being sought. It's a two-way flow. We do receive reports from foreign nations about people who have convictions that have similar laws in place. Americans don't hear a lot about that because the people who are not allowed in our country, we don't think a whole lot about. We only think about when we're being denied entry to another country.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Charles says, the UK can give a travel ban to the offender if there is a risk, but a judge makes the decision. He says it's very rare to be used. It's case-by-case basis. I got nothing to add to that, just relaying it.
Well, the United States has no travel ban. You can go anywhere you want to.
It's true. We're just going to tell where you're going that you're coming.
That's correct. There's nothing in international Megan's Law that prohibits you from traveling. The prerequisite is the notice if you're covered, and it's not even clear who all is covered that's required to give that notice because of the nuances of our 50-state registry scheme. Some don't have that requirement, and then it's not totally clear as to who all must give that notice, at least to me anyway. But there's nothing that prohibits you from traveling. You can go anywhere you like. They just may not admit you when you get there.
Yeah. All right, then let's move over from that. Go ahead, finish.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying. There's the people keep saying there's a travel ban. There isn't a travel ban. You can go, but what right do you have to enter a foreign nation?
Absolutely. All right, though, we're going to move over to this post. It's Jeremy in Indiana posted on the NARSA website. And it says, I'm very curious as to what this means and if it will have any policy effect at all. My eyes did perk up when I saw that ALI's, American Law Institute, 7-member were judges from different appeals courts around the country, and that their recommendations have been highly regarded by lawmakers in the past. My worry, though, is that RSOs, let's call them PFRs, are literally the most hated demographic in the entire world, and any effort by any politician to change these laws on this recommendation is going to cause a negative media sensation and potentially be political suicide for those politicians. I've asked in the past that NARSA avoid taking political sides on the spectrum, but this is probably the only time having a Democratic majority in Washington might actually benefit. If Republicans were to pass this, the media would crucify them. But since the mass media is controlled by Democrats, they will let this change happen with little fanfare. Unfortunately, with the political divide, I'm a little worried that conservative news outlets may try to crucify the Dems for the same reason. Luckily, the Dems have always been the standard bearers for criminal justice reform, so I do have high hopes. Interesting. I don't think that the Dems control the media like that, mass media. I just don't think that's accurate.
Well, I don't agree with that. I liked where he was headed until he got to the part about the Republicans would be vilified. First of all, the Republicans can't pass it because they're not in a majority right now. They don't have a Senate majority, so they couldn't pass it. They would need some Democratic votes. But I split with him when he said the Republicans would be vilified. I'm going to widen my challenge. I have had a challenge for a long time that no one has actually answered yet to show me a Democratic candidate vilifying a Republican on criminal justice matters, on reform, positive reforms. So I'm going to widen the challenge. Send me a media clip where the Republican Party is being vilified for criminal justice reform. We will play it on this podcast, and we will bash that media outlet, whoever it is, but that's just simply not true, that the Republicans would be bashed if they did that. And the media, and this is going to cause people to roll their eyes, the media is a reflection device. They don't generate much of the sensationalism. They receive a press release from an organization, or they receive a phone call from an organization, or from a candidate, or from a party official, whatever. And they are from a citizen, but there's someone agitating them. They're not that bright to go out and figure out, we're going to bash the Republicans. We're going to bash the Democrats today. they're looking for something that will drive ratings or paper sales or magazine sales. And controversy does that. And they respond. They're merely a reflection pool of public opinion. And I don't believe that they shape public opinion as much as people think they do. I think that talk radio does a lot more of the shaping of public opinion. But just standard news reporting, I don't think shapes public opinion that much.
I would agree. And when you move that into the Rachel Maddows and the Tuckers, which are very much just an opinion piece, opinion person, that is... That definitely gets people riled up, and that would shape a lot of the public opinion of things. Rush Limbaugh being certainly the biggest example, recently deceased.
Absolutely. Well, that is where the shaping of public opinion, when you have the talk show apparatus, whichever side, which is more dominated by conservatives by far. But you have lived in the state of Georgia for quite a number of years now.
Yes.
And Georgia did a significant amount of criminal justice reform under two Republican governors, Nathan Deal and more Deal, but somewhat under Perdue. And how much vilification did they get for that?
I don't recall. I went and sat in on a meeting of justice reform people, and someone said, yeah, he's really big. Nathan Deal, that is, was really big on giving people second chances. And I was like, really? And I mean, I didn't know up at that point. I was brand new in the movement, but I had never heard of a governor being like pro this or that. I was like, wow, that's really neat. I was kind of on board with him as a governor, just at least from that regard.
Well, I don't recall any vilification. Same thing with the vilification. Now, we go back to the presidential contest when the former governor of Arkansas ran for president, Mike Huckabee. He did get vilified for his pardons, but he got vilified from within his party. It was his opponents that were seeking the Republican nomination that said that he was too soft on crime. And the media merely reported that. I mean, that was his opponents. What are they supposed to do? Not report the news? But he was vilified by his opponents for his... He was pretty generous with handing out sentence commutations and pardons. I mean, I have to give the guy credit. He actually did believe in redemption. I mean, he was one of those born-again Christians, and he wore that on his sleeve. But he actually did practice it in the governor's office. So we have to be fair with him, that he believed it and he practiced it.
The one other point that I want to make about this is being news-driven, or excuse me, like ratings-driven, unless you remove that from your business model, then you can report on things in a different fashion. Your incentive structure is different, and I would be referring to the PBS NewsHour and NPR. They get their funding mostly from listener donations, and then they have other kinds of sponsorship money. But that takes the whole ratings thing out of the equation, that people, they provide incredibly, incredibly accurate, non-biased, slightly. I mean, a twinge, like pull a hair out of your head, that much. It's left biased, but not very much at all. And I'm a big fan.
I would think that if you were to poll your audience, you'd find out that most people think that PBS is very liberal bias, and they would not agree with you on that.
I know, but if you are all the way over to the right, then anything left of that, you would be, well, you're just a lefty biased person. And the same would go if you're an NBC watcher, like anything else is going to be right-leaning. I'm just saying from a panel that I saw that does this kind of rating thing of where do things fall as far as accuracy and bias, that those two things, USA Today, I think, was very much, very highly accurate, like a source of news information, and also just slightly left biased. Just that's what I have researched to find out, because I'm very interested in finding an NPR type thing that's right leaning, and I can't find anything remotely close to something that would give me a right slant on things that is highly accurate, doesn't scream at people, etc.
Well, I agree that I would consider them a reliable source, but I'm saying the average person, when they think about that as a lefty communist organization, when you talk about PBS.
Yes, I know. Okay, well then let's move on. I think we're just here at the main event. I think we're ready to just jump over into this South Carolina court case.
We have the listener contributions from the prisoner. To be read.
Okay, let me find it real quick. I don't want to do editing later. I didn't pull that one up. Let me get that out of the Dropbox folder. To be read. Do 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 do. Oh, I do have that pulled up. Sorry. To be read. I got it. It says, Dear Andy and Larry. This is from a Douglas in up in St. Louis, Missouri. It says, I'm writing in response to your request for testimonials on the reliability of transcript arrival that appeared in episode 178, recorded 5/22/21. I am a state PFR prisoner in Michigan Department of Corrections, and I generally receive the transcript the Friday after it was recorded. Note the date of this letter. Sometimes it may come the following week on Monday or Tuesday. But considering the Michigan Department of Corrections recently started giving us copies of our mail instead of the originals, I would say that the delivery time is excellent. I would like to attest to the reliability of transcript reception, and the information you guys provide to us still on the inside has been greatly appreciated. Thank you. I would also like to subscribe to another 6 months of the Registry Matters transcripts attached to the envelope sent to the Michigan Department of Corrections disbursement for $36 plus applicable Michigan tax. Keep going through that whole section too, Larry.
I think that we covered the most salient point, but he did mention something about his conviction, and he's got some post-conviction action going. He says that I brought my ineffective assistance of counsel claim before the court, and they actually assigned a state attorney to file it. My claim has merit, as my attorney has let me plead to 20-year felonies when I committed a 4-year felony while having a mental health factor exhibited throughout. If that is anything approximating accuracy, and sometimes there's a misunderstanding, but if you plead to a crime that didn't exist, that conviction is void on its face. If there has to be subject matter jurisdiction for the court to enter a judgment. So if they take a plea for a crime that didn't happen, then that conviction is void because there was not subject matter jurisdiction of the court to start with. So Douglas, I'm very interested in hearing more as this progresses, because there's not enough information in the letter to tell us precisely what you're saying, and we don't have the time on the podcast to really unpack that. But if you plead to something, that's why they do a factual basis. When you're ready to do a change of plea from not guilty to guilty, that's why they have a factual basis laid out. So the prosecution generally will say, on or about this date, the defendant did this within the county of, and they'll go through laying the foundation. And in violation of this particular section of law, they'll name the section of the statute that was violated. And at the conclusion of that factual basis, the judge will ask the defense attorney, have you discussed this with your client, this plea? Does your client understand? Do you agree that this factual basis is not precisely what they're going to say? But the judge will ascertain that there is a factual basis. You can't take a plea unless a crime was committed. Isn't that amazing that you can't take a plea unless a crime occurred?
I mean, sure, that sounds about right, doesn't it?
Yeah, but people say all the time that they pled guilty if there was no evidence. When the factual basis is presented, you agree in front of the judge that there was a factual basis that a crime did occur. If they cannot lay out a factual basis to support the plea, a plea can't be accepted.
To close out his letter, says, by the way, I am distributing the copies of the past RM transcripts around to other PFR housing units to spread the word and maybe spark some more subscriptions for you. It is difficult because this facility has been on COVID lockdown for what seems like forever. But I am taking the advice offered in the April-May issue of NARSL's The Digest, doing what I can from the inside. Oh, it was nice to read about Michigan's registry changes in the insider section. The guy who wrote it, James, is a good friend of mine and actually helped me file a motion for the court to get the state attorney mentioned above assigned to me. And thank you, Registry Matters, for everything you do. It is appreciated. And thank you very much for all of that, Doug. Very cool.
All right. So now we can go to the two court cases. We have the Supreme Court of the United States and Borden versus the United States, which shouldn't take too terribly long. And then we're going to go into the case from the great state of South Carolina.
Awesome. And it looks like it's 69 pages. And Larry, I like suffered my way through it, including the dissenting opinions. And I see no relevance to this. I think we should just toss it in the garbage.
Why should we do that?
Because it has no relevance.
Well, it does have some relevance. It has to do with textual interpretation and how the conservative bloc in the court tried to read beyond the text to interpret the ACCA to permit enhanced sentences.
Tell me again what ACCA is, please. What the hell is that?
Oh, I apologize. Sometimes I forget to explain the acronym. The ACCA is the Armed Career Criminal Act, which mandates a 15-year minimum sentence for persons found guilty of illegally possessing a firearm who have three or more prior convictions for a, quote, violent felony. The issue before the court is a violent felony required by the ACCA in order for a person to be subjected to enhancement. The liberals joined two conservatives, Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas, and they held that we should actually follow the law, that there should be a violent felony before you can be subject, because that's what the language of the law says. Imagine that, Andy, following the law.
Wait a minute. So they write down that you got to do a thing, and then they punish you for not doing a thing?
Right. You have to commit a violent felony, and you have to have three or more of them to be subject to the ACCA. And
okay.
So there's four conservatives who do not really think that it has to be a violent felony. But two conservatives joined. So those conservatives are Justice Gorsuch. And for the first time in recent memory, Justice Thomas found a criminal law that he found some disagreement with. So, but yeah, it's amazing.
All right. So according to the syllabus, petitioner Charles Borden Jr. pleaded guilty to a felony in possession charge, and then the government sought to enhance the sentence under the ACCA. One of the three convictions alleged as predicates for the enhancement was reckless aggravated assault in violation of Tennessee law. Borden argued that this offense is not a violent felony under ACC elements clause because a mental state of recklessness suffices for conviction. In his view, only purposeful or knowing conduct satisfy the clause. Demand for use of force against the person of another. By a slim 5-4 majority, the Supreme Court reversed the lower court's decision. Okay. So what did the conservative dissenting judges argue?
Well, they argued that three convictions only required a mental state of reckless, which is what was in the Tennessee law. But see, reckless is like the accident I had a few weeks ago.
Okay.
That person never left home intending to hurt me.
Sure. Just distracted or whatever.
Yes, he was distracted. So the Armed Career Crime Act was intended and written specifically to require an intentional violent felony. So therefore, reckless isn't an intentional violent felony. I mean, it's really straightforward. But the reason why I put this in here, and we don't need to spend a lot of time on it, is because, you know, the conservatives pride themselves in how they're textual and everything. Well, the text of the law is pretty clear. But they contorted and they twisted, trying to figure out a way to allow for longer prison sentences. So that's why I put it in.
All right. And it says, if you have nothing further, then let's move on to the next case. This case has been talked about quite a bit over the past few days. The name of it is Dennis J. Powell Jr. versus Mark Keel, Chief, State Law Enforcement Division and the State of South Carolina. Appellants. It's not a super long opinion, so I read it myself. Larry, can you briefly tell us what put Mr. Powell on the registry?
I can. On February 23rd, 2008, Powell was arrested for criminal solicitation of a minor under a section of South Carolina law for engaging in anonymous internet chat room conversations, which were graphically sexual in nature, with an undercover police officer posing as a 12-year-old girl. But he didn't just stop with graphic conversation, which I would argue is protected. But in their final conversation, Powell and the teenage girl arranged to meet at a skating rink in Lexington. Thereafter, he drove by the meeting place and was pulled over by law enforcement at a traffic stop and was subsequently arrested.
Sure, I see. It's one of those sting operations. Well, before we get into the details of the case, I know that you have a great angst about statutes dealing with internet communications and graphic conversations. And I also know that you did a deep study of all the solicitation statutes across the United States about 10 years ago, which is a tool you provide attorneys all over the United States. How does South Carolina's compare, and are there constitutional issues with the statute, in your opinion?
Actually, you're right. I did do that study, and I think I put it in the folder for anybody who wants to look at it. I've got a compendium of all the 50 states, and it was great when I did it. There could have been changes, and the laws would have been changed to make them less favorable than they would have been 10 years ago. But actually, their statute is very much constitutional. I wish I could say that it isn't, but it is very well constructed, and I can't find any constitutional flaws.
No constitutional flaws? What the hell? Why do we have you here then? Let's see here. So what in particular makes their statute better than others then?
Well, if you look at it, let's just read the statute. When you look at section 16-15-342 and South Carolina law, a person 18 years of age or older commits the offense of criminal solicitation of a minor if he knowingly contacts or communicates with or attempts to contact or communicate with a person who is under the age of 18. So let's stop there for a moment. So he has to knowingly be doing that, communicating or contact a person under 18. So we've got the first threshold. We've got the what I talk about is scienter. He has to know that he's talking to a minor. It can't be an accident.
Okay.
Or a person that he reasonably believes to be under age of 18, but it doesn't stop there. So this is where my graphic argument, you can have graphic conversation because you can have fantasies and that's protected. But he has to do that for the purpose of, with the intent of persuading, inducing, or enticing, or coercing the person to engage in or participate in a sexual activity as defined in South Carolina law, or a violent crime. So therefore, we've got the knowing, and we got the intentional, and we have a clear intent of sexual activity. And sexual activity is not protected speech with a minor. So you've just shot all the constitutional issues that I have out the window, because I can fantasize about all the money in the vault. And I can tell right. you, I wish I right. had every dollar of it. But I cannot attempt to make any effort to retrieve that money from the vault. But the fantasy is just fine. And so therefore, if you're having a conversation with someone who's 12 years old, it's untasteful. And maybe there should be a law that says you can't have graphic conversation. And that would be a different law. But if you're going to prosecute a person for soliciting to have sex, you should have to prove that they're intending to have sex. And that's what this law requires in South Carolina. So therefore, I would be very challenged to come up with a constitutional argument that would have any chance of success on the construction of this statute. The construction makes it clear that words are not being criminalized. The state must prove that you knowingly communicated with an underage individual, and they must prove intent to engage in something illegal. Having a fantasy is not sufficient to convict.
I remember hearing that you and I can talk about robbing the bank all we want, but when somebody goes to rent the van, that's when things get hairy.
Well, we got to be careful how much talk about robbing, because then again, it's illegal to rob banks. So if I'm talking about beginning to plan the actual, if I say, gee, I wish I had all the money in the bank, that's not illegal to wish you have the money. But if I start saying, I would like to rob the bank, what about you? Well, yeah. Then I'm pretty close to a solicitation, because you can't solicit right. someone to engage in something that would be unlawful if they did it. And I can pretty well assure you that asking you if you would like to do something that's unlawful, that would put you in jeopardy of prosecution. So I can't go there, because I've at least done a solicitation.
Do you want to rob that bank? I'm just asking. Nobody's listening. It's just between you and me.
No, I don't think so.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast.
We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Okay, well, I noticed that the case was decided on Mr. Powell's motion for summary judgment. Boy, do you like those. I know you people have generally expressed reservations about summary judgment, so let me rib you on that. Summary judgment can't be all bad?
But you're correct on all points. We will address summary judgment later on after we explain the issues that were in play. This appeal was from the circuit court's grant of summary judgment in favor of Mr. Powell on his claims challenging the internet public on his claims, and he challenged the internet publication and lifetime registration. And he was granted a summary judgment in his favor. And the circuit court, which is the trial court, held that South Carolina's Registration Act lifetime registration requirement is punitive under the Eighth Amendment and violates his rights to due process and equal protection. The circuit court also determined that SORA does not permit publication of the state sex offender registry on the internet. So he won at the trial court on both of two significant claims.
I like that internet one. I'm guessing that the state of South Carolina has appealed.
They did appeal. That's how we got here. They did. The appeal was by the Mark Keel, the chief of the law enforcement. They call it SLED, S-L-E-D, in the state of South Carolina. And the South Carolina Supreme Court held that SORA, lifetime registration requirement, is unconstitutional absent any opportunity for judicial review to assess risk of reoffending. This means he won on that claim. Unfortunately, he lost on the internet dissemination issue. The Supreme Court held, and that's the South Carolina Supreme Court, held that subsection 23-3-490E permits dissemination of the state sex offender registry information on the internet, that is constitutional, which gets me back to my distaste for summary judgment.
How so? If they won at the trial court on both issues, is it the attorney's fault that the Supreme Court reversed?
Well, not necessarily. They did win at the trial court. But where that comes into the problem, I think if you reflect back to the Tenth Circuit, when I said we don't have evidence to support what Judge Mache did. You remember that?
Right. I do.
Okay. Well, that's the same situation here. The trial judge can hate the internet dissemination all he or she wants to. But you have to put on evidence to show. See, we've got a U.S. Supreme Court decision in 2003 that says that the state of Connecticut, that's Connecticut, Doe versus Connecticut Department of Public Safety. I'll get it right in a moment. But the Supreme Court has said that you have every right to disseminate this information. But see, since 2003, there's a lot more information being disseminated that wasn't. The internet has much broader reach than it did in 2003, and it has far more debilitating consequences than it did in 2003. And the required information that's disseminated is far greater. As the Supreme Court said in 2003, the mere fact that you're convicted of a sexual offense is already a matter of public record. And the registry is merely disseminating what's already public. Now, 20 years later, 20 years later, we have a whole different scenario. We have the internet disseminating the vehicle you drive, where you work, where you attend school. And I can go on and on with information they disseminate about you. In some instances, your internet identifiers, and different states disseminate different information. And I don't know exactly what else disseminated in South Carolina. But in order to develop that and to show the debilitating effects of that dissemination, you would need a trial, unless you could get the state to stipulate that all these debilitating conditions exist. And that would be unlikely. You'd be able to get them to stipulate to those facts. Therefore, in summary judgment, the record is going to be very thin, and it was very thin.
Not only that, the number of people that are on the internet using that as their primary vehicle of getting information is radically different than it was 19 years ago.
Yep.
So where do we go from here? What's the next step?
Well, I think I've lost my own notes, and I'm the one that put these together. So what page are we on here?
We are at the very top of the second. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to cite the legal standard for overturning a law. It says, the court said, this court has limited scope of review in cases involving a constitutional challenge to a statute because all statutes are presumed constitutional and, if possible, will be construed to render them valid. And then they said, a legislative act will not be declared unconstitutional unless its repugnance to the Constitution is clear and beyond a reasonable doubt. And I'm doing that from memory. Sure.
So, yeah, that is actually in the opinion. And so you've got a great memory, or did you read the opinion or both?
All of the above.
All of the above. Well, so you see, I don't make this stuff up, but we've mentioned this legal standard countless times on the podcast, that the presumption goes in favor of the law being constitutional. And I think this is the first time that I've seen the term repugnant. Is that actually in there? Does it say that?
Yes, it does, actually.
Oh, okay. So, well, oh, I tell you, I don't make this stuff up. And that is, in fact, the legal standard. You start with the presumption, and the burden is on the challenging party, and it's a very significant burden that must be overcome.
All right. Well, South Carolina requires any person, regardless of age, who has been convicted of an enumerated crime on their list to register as a PFR for life. The act also provides judges with the discretion to order, as a condition of sentencing, a person convicted of an offense not listed in the statute to be included in this PFR registry if good cause is shown by the prosecutor. As I read the decision, Larry, the requirement for registration for life with no opportunity for removal is the problem. Do I have that right?
You absolutely do. That is precisely what the court said. And I will quote now. Notably, SORA does not provide any judicial review for registrants to demonstrate their individual risk of recidivism and seek removal from the registry. You don't really need me here tonight because it seems like you've got this covered. Further, the court said, we agree with the respondent, and that would be Powell, that SORA's lifetime registration requirement without judicial review violates due process. That's what the court said.
And as I understand it, the 14th Amendment provides that no state shall, blah, 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 deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. All states have a similar clause in their constitution. Explain the significance to me, Larry, of the fact that this case was decided based on the U.S. Constitution. But in the past, you've said that some states provide greater protection. I believe that Maryland is one of those. Is that a potential issue here?
It is a potential issue. And since the South Carolina Constitution, to my knowledge, has not been interpreted to provide greater protections for its citizens than the U.S. Constitution, that means that this case could ultimately be decided by the United States Supreme Court. And that was not the case when you look at the Pennsylvania decision or the Maryland decision, either one of those. The Supreme Courts in those states said, you can look at this all you want to, but we're deciding it on our Constitution. And Maryland has that very great clause about no disadvantages can be imposed retroactively. And I can't recite the clause in Pennsylvania because I was not actively working on that particular challenge. But the Pennsylvania Constitution and the Maryland Constitution provide greater protections. New Mexico's Constitution does as well. But since this is a U.S. constitutional question, this opens the door to the United States Supreme Court review.
Well, then, since 2003, Packingham, whatever, we've been wanting to get cases to get to the Supreme Court to try and chip away at this stuff. So why is this such a bad thing? Isn't this what we've been trying to get to for so many years?
Are you talking about overturning Smith versus Doe?
All of the above. Yeah, Smith, when I said 2003, that's what I was referring to, is Smith versus Doe. And then just all the cases that we try and funnel up there to try and chip away at this whole thing. But so why is this such a bad thing?
Well, I don't know what you mean when you say the term we, because I certainly have never been a big proponent of getting this issue back before the U.S. Supreme Court. I have little confidence that they would actually render a favorable decision. Why do you think that the Michigan ACLU was so adamantly opposed to the state of Michigan cert petition in the Doe versus Snyder case? If they had been confident of a favorable outcome, they would have not opposed the cert petition. A, it would have meant more money for them for legal fees, and B, it would have meant that would become the case law of the entire country. They didn't have that confidence, nor do I.
Well, damn it, Larry, there you go again, being negative. Let me ask the question differently. Do you expect that the South Carolina will change their law in the next 12 months as the court has recommended?
No, I actually don't think that they will do that.
Why not?
Well, it's really not as complicated to explain. The status quo is in place as a result of this. Nothing changes. Mr. Powell gets off the registry, but the status quo will remain in place for the next 12 months, which the Supreme Court extended the legislature an invitation to incorporate a removal process. But there's no date certain that would compel the legislature to legislate, which would mean taking a political risk that would make things better for PFRs. Can you imagine what would happen to a legislator who dared to risk putting forth a proposal that would allow PFRs to be removed from the registry? How would that go over with the average resident in South Carolina?
Well, that puts us back to the other option. If they're not likely to change the law, so this is similar to Michigan, would it not be logical to anticipate a cert petition? Would that not buy them time because they could credibly say that the matter is still in litigation?
That's exactly what it would do. That's brilliant. That's exactly what it would do. Because if you're being afforded a 12-month opportunity to legislate, and you know that legislation is not likely because you're not going to support it, as the state attorney general is not likely to support the legislation, that would give them exactly what you said. The credibility would say, well, you know, there's this matter still. I mean, there's a Supreme Court cert petition. I think they have, in normal circumstances, 3 months to file it. And I think that's been extended during the pandemic. I think it's like a 5-month time. So we really won't know right away if they're going to file a petition unless they announce that publicly. But it would be more likely than not, in my opinion, that they would file a cert petition.
So, Larry, I've legit just had a like terrible flashback way back to the case that was decided below, and that it would be an issue that this case was decided on motion for summary judgment, which means that there's no trial to develop facts below. Will that be a potential problem if SCOTUS then goes and decides the case? Oh, I see. Yeah.
It would potentially be, but I don't think it would be as big a risk in this particular instance, because the issue that would be going up did not need as much factual development, because unless they were to file seek cert on the internet component that they lost, which I don't, the winning party Powell, he's not going to seek cert. He's not going to file for cert, right? He's happy. He's off the registry. So he's not going to file. So that issue that was not decided in his favor is no longer relevant here. This is going to be a state of South Carolina cert petition if there were to be one. And they're not going to ask the Supreme Court to review an issue that they won. So the issue that they lost is what they're going to be asking for a review on, which is the lifetime registration without due process. And this is really a straightforward, the issue the Supreme Court would be deciding is not whether a person's required to register for life. It's whether they can be required to register for life without any due process, or with the due process that was afforded them in their original conviction, is that sufficient? And the South Carolina Supreme Court has now recognized that registration implicates a liberty interest, and a person cannot be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The question would be, was the original due process sufficient for lifetime registration and deprivation of that liberty? And I have no idea what the Supremes would say on that. I'm very concerned, because you did have some form of due process at the time of your original conviction. And what if 5 of the 9 were to say that is sufficient? Then what?
Okay, so let's go at this from another angle. Let's assume that the legislature in South Carolina has an epiphany and they wish to provide some level of due process because they respect the decision of the higher court. I'm not nearly as skeptical as you. Why wouldn't they? Obligatory laugh there, Larry.
Oh, I love that laugh. Well, for 3 reasons. First, the status quo has not been disturbed by this decision. Remember, only Powell is off the registry. Second, it would be a very risky political move to want to make things better for a PFR. So let's do the calendar. 2021, June, the decision came out from the state Supreme Court. They said, please legislate within 12 months. Their assembly doesn't convene until January. And according to my contact in South Carolina. They'll run through toward late May of 2022. Guess what happens in 22? An election.
Right.
And a significant number of those legislators are up for re-election, as is the South Carolina Attorney General. So that's a risky political move in an election year to want to do things that helps PFR. And again, folks, please, I don't make these rules. I'm just helping you analyze what the considerations are. And third, and significantly important, due process costs money. Expending public resources on PFRs is not a politically popular position. If you're going to give anybody meaningful due process, it's going to require money.
All right, you and I were chatting about this, and you did mention one point that you really felt was important about the decision. You noted that the South Carolina Supreme Court recognized that there is no, and let me put this in quotes, there's no federal registry. Can you explain that, please?
They did. They quoted, and I love it. They said, Congress enacted DORA, which is South Carolina's federal counterpart, the Sexual Offender Registration Notification Act, which contains a provision seeking to require states to make their sex offender registries available to the public on the internet. Each jurisdiction, again quoting, shall make available on the internet in a manner that is readily available to all jurisdictions as well as the public all information about each sex offender in the registry. The jurisdiction shall maintain the internet site in a manner it will permit the public to obtain relevant information for each sex offender by a single query for any given zip code or geographic radius set by the user. And I'm going to ask you to read the most relevant quote from the court opinion, the quote there.
All right. So it says, however, we do not believe this provision of SORA's is dispositive of the statutory interpretation issue before the court. Indeed, the federal law does not require states to implement its provisions because it was enacted pursuant to Congress's spending power by placing conditions of the receipt of federal funds.
Okay, so we can conclude from that quote that a unanimous Supreme Court is either not able to understand what I've been saying for many years, that there's not a federal registry, or I don't know how else to explain it. Folks, there isn't a federal registry.
That is the language that the writing, Larry, is like dispositive. Like, could you translate that into dumb for me, please?
Well, there was an argument about the state of South Carolina was arguing that even though our statute is a little unclear at the state level about the authority and the requirement to disseminate the information, we're required to do this by federal law. And so they fell back on the federal argument. You know, we want to be in compliance with the big old bad federal government that we hate. Typically, you know, most conservative states, they decry the federal government except when it's something that they like. So they argued that, and the state Supreme Court unanimously, and I have to assume that in a Republican-dominated state, there's some conservatives on that Supreme Court. I can't imagine a bunch of liberal pointy heads got elected in South Carolina to the Supreme Court.
Probably not.
They have said what I have said, that it's only the power of the purse. If you want those precious federal dollars, you will do these things, but you're not required to do this. You could turn your registry off tomorrow. And there would be nothing the federal government could do about it other than withhold your money.
Burn funds? B-U-R-N? How do you spell that word?
I believe it's burn, B-Y-R-N-E.
Okay, B-Y-R-N. And that's burn grant money, I believe?
Yep, 10% of that.
Okay, and it's I noticed another footnote where they said, to the extent this opinion conflicts with Hendricks versus Taylor, 353 South Carolina Code, or SC? What is SC? Is that South Carolina?
South Carolina, yes.
Okay, and then 542,579 SE Second Edition 320/2003. Good grief, dude. I don't know where they come up with this notation because no human can actually understand it. But it says it's hereby overruled. Is that significant?
Okay, so since you brought that up, so we'll dissect this. So what this means, if you were in a law library and you were looking up this case, which nobody does anymore, but if you were in a law library and you were looking up these two, the 353 SC that South Carolina reports, so there'd be a South Carolina reporter on the shelving in the library. So you'd go to volume So you would go to volume 353. So there'd be rows after row of the South Carolina reports, and you would pick. You would go to page 542, and that case would appear on it. And then if you were in another state like I am, so we're not going to have South Carolina reports here. So I would go to the Southeastern Reporter, which we would have. I think they still carry the books for the South. So I'd go to page 579 of the Southeastern second edition, and I would find this case on starting on page 320. That's what that means.
Good grief, dude. I guess it's the Dewey Decimal System for legal pointy head people.
No, it's not that complicated. You just go down the rack looking for volume for that volume number, and then you'd flip to that page number, and that's where the decision would begin.
Okay, Larry, we'll start talking about computers and routing and ports and IP addresses, and we'll see how uncomplicated it is for you.
So is
that significant, though?
It is. That case, the Hendricks versus Taylor, is the equivalent at the state level of Smith versus Doe at the U.S. Supreme Court level. So this means that they have recognized, as their sister courts across the country have also concluded, that they're now agreeing that the registry has gone too far. And it took them a long time, but it means that they've joined their sister courts around the country that have begun to say, hey, this is too much. But again, the lawmakers just really can't help themselves. So they keep piling on and piling on, and they end up in this position because of their own choices.
Certainly. All right. Well, we've been doing this for really like more than 30 minutes, I think. Let me ask what everyone wants to know. Will anyone other than Powell get off the registry as a result of this case, and how soon? So who else does this impact?
Right now, no one other than Powell will get off. And if they did the part that we hope they would do, which would be to legislate a due process within a year, then it would take some time for that process to be implemented, because you've got to design it and you've got to get the directions out to how to implement the process. So you're talking about a longer term project if they were to take the course of action. So let's just say that they have the epiphany that you talked about. It would be, it would be 2 years before anybody would get off. If they take the more likely course of action, which is to file the cert petition, and even if the cert petition is denied, let's say it takes 3 months to file the cert petition, if that's the deadline, because that's the normal deadline without the extension of the pandemic. If they file a cert petition, of course, Powell's going to file a response, and possibly other entities such as NARSL would file a response saying there's no need to grant cert. This is a brilliant decision, and it needs to stand. It would be very dangerous for it to be reviewed. So Powell would not want it to be reviewed. He likes his victory. So if it were to go that direction, you'd be talking about several years, because the Supreme Court, if they were to grant cert, then they have to order briefing. And they have to schedule oral arguments. They have to hold oral arguments. They generally announce their decisions at the end of the term that they grant the cert petition. So if they were to grant a cert petition anytime before the end of 2021, which would be a really rapid movement, they wouldn't have a decision until 2022. So that from that point, depending on what the decision was, you know, you're talking about a long term. So folks, don't plan to get off the registry anytime soon because of this. It's highly unlikely, but we can hope for it. The epiphany is what we hope for, that they will say the attorney general will dismiss any concerns about his reelection, and that he will advise the legislature that they should have due process, that they will discount any concern they have about the cost, because you got thousands of people in the registry, and without some precise guidance, if everyone's eligible, there'd be a rapid number of petitions. So you'd have to set up something where there would be some criteria for being eligible to file a petition after a certain amount of time on the registry. Then you've got to figure out who gets served the petition, who the responding party is. They have to have additional resources to investigate the petition, depending on what's required. I mean, all this stuff is going to cost money. Are you going to provide any help for the indigent people, or is this just going to be a petition that's available to those who have financial resources, like typically it is in the states that provide a removal process? There's just so much involved in this, so it's going to be long-term. This is not an instantaneous thing that's going to provide relief.
But let's just say there's somebody that is a very similar case to this individual, Powell. This is persuasive decision. Don't they get to then cite this, and next week they're filing a court challenge? Doesn't this just then apply to them almost identically?
You're absolutely right. That's also a brilliant observation. That's exactly what you would do. And what I would do if I were tasked for representing South Carolina, what I would do is I would ask in response to that petition, because see, that would not be filed in the Supreme Court. That would be filed in a trial court somewhere in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
So what, mm-hmm. what I would do is I would file a response to that and say, this petition is premature because the year hasn't passed yet, and we do not know if they're going to legislate or not. And therefore, since the Supreme Court has said they have a year and they're encouraged, since they're the best situated to legislate a remedy, this is premature, so just sit on it. And I would put forth that argument. I don't know if it would be successful or not. It could be that if they were as favorable as this Powell was, he has had that one case and he had successfully completed treatment and he had done everything right, no additional encounters with the law. Right. And they determined that he was a good candidate for removal. So that, I don't know if that would be the outcome. But if I can think of putting up that argument, trust me, I'm not letting the rabbit out of the hat. They can think of that, and that's what they would argue. They would say that this is premature. We need to let the process be developed, and we need to not jump the gun here. We want to make sure that we're letting off the people that should be getting off, and therefore we would ask you to hold this petition in abeyance. And I just about bet that that's what the judge would do, would hold the petition in abeyance.
And I'm going to repeat back what you just said, is if I file that same thing, I'm exactly like this Powell guy. They're going to say, hey, come back to us after the legislature has done their work. They're just going to kick me out saying, hang on, come back later.
Well, like I say, my request to the court would be that it be held in abeyance until we see if the legislature is going to legislate. I don't know if the court would grant that, but that would be my response, because when you file the petition, there's going to be a response filed, and that would be my response. Is I would say, hey, you know, we're likely, I would do a flip flop, just like what they're going to do. I would right now would argue that we're likely to get something out of the legislature, even knowing that you're not likely to get anything out of the legislature. But I would say that it's quite likely, because of the strong encouragement of the Supreme Court, that the legislature will create something, and therefore we don't want to jump the gun and try to legislate from the bench. We want to let this process work, even though it's not going to work. But that's what you would argue, and you would ask that the petition be dismissed, but it be held in abeyance until the legislature legislates. They're not going to legislate, folks.
And because I don't know this word at all, what does abeyance mean? Abayance?
It would be that they just would not make any decision on it. They would just sit there while we're waiting for this year to pass.
Okay. The definition from Google is the condition of being temporarily set aside, suspension. Okay.
Correct.
Not really familiar with that word, but it says it's a legal term, Larry. You got to define these things for us dumb people here.
Well, trust me, they can think of that if I can think of that, because I've never professed to be brilliant, and that's what they would likely argue.
Sure. And so you said it's going to take, on the optimistic side, it takes a year for them to go do legislative stuff, and it takes some time for that to go through before that whole legislative process would be done. And then you got to wait for the governor to sign it, and there's got to be some sort of implementation mechanism. You're talking 2 or 3 years before anything would happen for the people that are just waiting, that might have something else apply to them, that where they could get off the registry.
Well, with the epiphany that you're hoping for and that I'm hoping for, they decide something in the 2022 session, and it takes effect July 1st. That's a really optimistic thing that they could make it effective that fast, because they don't have this and they're creating it from scratch. So they're probably going to set an effective date, maybe January 1st of 2022, so they can gear up for it. So you've got a process at the very most optimistic thing is going to become available and operational January 1st, 2022.
For clarity, Larry, that's like 6 months from now. Do you mean 23 by chance?
Yes, I mean 2023.
Okay, good. Because I was like, they're not in session now, I assume. That's already out. You're talking like special sessions and all that. And I can guarantee that's not happening.
Oh, no, they're not going to do a special session. So we're looking at January of 2023 before it be up and operational. Then you got to file your petition. You've got to serve it. You've got to let the responding party, whoever they determine that is, it's more than likely going to be the prosecutor in the county of conviction, or in the county of your residence if you have an out-of-state conviction, and that they have to respond. And then there's going to have to be a hearing set. If they design it for a hearing, hearings take time, cost money, they consume court and judicial resources. So all this stuff is going to take time. There's no instant answers.
Okay. And with your usual pessimism, You just can't even help yourself, can you?
I don't know if it's a question of not being able to help myself. I can't help myself to tell people things that I don't really believe to be the case. And I don't believe that this is going to do anything anytime soon to help folks. It's a fabulous decision, but I don't think we're going to see any relief anytime in the immediate future.
I can tell you that over on Reddit, it has been burning up the sex offender support channel over there. And then there was a massive conversation going over on our Discord server yesterday or day before. I think pretty sure it was yesterday. There's 5 or 6, 7 people talking about it for like 2 hours almost. Just beating around, going back and forth. This has definitely lit up our universe as far as people having conversations and postulating about what's going to happen with this whole thing.
Well, I'd be interested to hear what some of the comments are. Is that going to bring the registry down next week? Is that what they're saying?
That would certainly be one of those things.
Wow.
All right. Well, we are almost like exactly at an hour, Larry. Is there anything else? Do we have any articles that you want to touch on before we scoot on out of here?
Well, let's see. On these articles, I think that there was not anything that I really had a passion for on these. I was putting them in case we didn't have anything, but we had these two decisions.
Yep, I'm with you. And those will all be in the show notes if you want to find a PDF of them that Larry has provided for us, which is super awesome as usual. But of course, we got a new patron this week. Larry, tell me quickly about this new patron. This new patron is Kay. How did Kay find us?
Kay found us because of our discussion of revocation of supervision on interstate offenders who've been transferred in due process, those probable cause hearings. And she has a loved one who's needing a probable cause hearing. And somehow or another, you can explain that about how those keywords search, but it popped up and they listened to our episodes and they found them fascinating. So I ended up talking to Kay at great length, as a matter of fact.
But the point is Kay is not a PFR-related person. This is some other kind of crime that was committed.
That is correct. I've omitted that. But yes, that has nothing to do with our issue. It's the process that we explain. And she said they listened to those episodes multiple times because they found that no attorney they could speak with could explain the interstate compact the way we did.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Kay, for joining up, and look forward to communicating with you in the future. And then we also had one that we may have forgotten to mention, but so a podcast transcript person from Inside the Walls. And Jason, we may have forgotten to mention that individual. And then also a new one is Lindsay. So Jason is in Indiana and Lindsay is in Illinois. That's super stellar. Please pass that around to your folks behind the walls there and stay safe. And again, thank you so very much. Anything else before we shut everything down, Larry?
In terms of the transcript, it is possible this episode will go out on schedule. It is possible that the next episode may be late because I could be traveling and I'm integral to the production and creation and distribution of the transcript, but I'm not sure yet, but I could be traveling, so you will get it. It just may be late.
Yeah, and actually, let me mention that if you are traveling, then our schedule of recording could be off. It could be sometime Saturday, or it could even be pushed back to Sunday. Who knows where all of us will be at what time, because I have to bring Larry equipment to record a podcast. But, Larry, with all of that, you can find show notes over at Registry Matters, registrymatters.co. You find the latest episode and all of our back issues. You can leave voicemail at 727-227. Oh my God, I did that wrong. 747-227-4477. Email registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Of course, best way to support the show is patreon.com/registrymatters. Larry, I thank you so very much. You are the explainer in chief for all things PFR registry related stuff. And I hope you have a fantastic week and I will talk to you soon.
Thank you so much. That is why I am here.
Oh, wait, I can play that for you. Here, 1, 2, 3.
That is why I am here.
Oh, you were supposed to do it in sync. Try that again sometime. All right, Larry, have a great night. I will talk to you soon.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.